We took the shitty Mazda and drove to Babiki's house. I was an hour late picking her up. She was completely pissed off. Tom had to go in and convince her to come out. And eventually, she did. She was even more gorgeous than before, in an amazing red dress, but she was clearly not in a great mood. Inside, I was quietly starting to panic, but I smiled and kept trying my gentlemanly best to be a good date, holding the door for her, telling her how beautiful she was. Tom and the sister gave us a send-off, and we headed out. Then, I got lost. The dance was being held at some venue in a part of town I wasn't familiar with, and at some point, I got completely turned around and had no idea where I was. I drove around for an hour in the dark, going left, going right, doubling back. I was on my cell phone the whole time, desperately calling people, trying to figure out where I was, trying to get directions. Babiki sat next to me, in stony silence the whole time, clearly not feeling me or this night at all. I was crashing hard. I was late. I didn't know where I was going. I was the worst date she'd ever had in her life. I finally figured out where I was, and we made it to the dance, nearly 2 hours late. I parked, jumped out, and ran around to get her door. When I opened it, she just sat there. "Are you ready?" I said. "Let's go in." "No." "No? What do you mean, no?" "No." "Okay, but why?" "No." "But we need to go inside. The dance is inside." "No." I stood there for another 20 minutes, trying to convince her to come inside, but she kept saying no. She wouldn't get out of the car. Finally, I said, "Okay, I'll be right back." I ran inside and found Bongani. "Where have you been?" he said. "I'm here, but my date's in the car and she won't come in." "What do you mean she won't come in?" "I don't know what's going on. Please help me." We went back out to the parking lot. I took Bongani over to the car, and the second he saw her, he lost it. "Jesus in heaven, this is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen." "You said she was beautiful, Trevor, but this is insane." In an instant, he completely forgot about helping me with Babiki. He turned, ran back inside, and called to the guys. "Guys, you gotta come see this. Trevor got a date, and she's beautiful. Guys, come out here." 20 guys came running out into the parking lot. They clustered around the car. "Yo, she's so hot. Dude, this girl came with Trevor?" Guys were gawking at her like she was an animal in the zoo. They were asking to take pictures with her. They were calling back to more people inside. "This is insane. Look at Trevor's date. No, 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 no. You gotta come and see." I was mortified. I'd spent 4 years of high school carefully avoiding any kind of romantic humiliation whatsoever. And now, on the night of the matric dance, the night of all nights, my humiliation had turned into a circus bigger than the event itself. Trevor, the undateable clown, thought he was going to have the most beautiful girl at the dance, but he's crashing and burning, so let's all go outside and watch. Babiki sat in the passenger seat, staring straight ahead, refusing to budge. I was outside the car, pacing, stressed out. A friend of mine had a bottle of brandy that he'd smuggled into the dance. "Here," he said, "have some of this." Nothing mattered at that point, so I started drinking. I'd fucked up. The girl didn't like me. The night was done. Most of the guys eventually wandered back inside. I was sitting on the pavement, taking swigs from the brandy bottle, getting buzzed. At some point, Bongani went back over to the car to try one last time to convince Babiki to come in. After a minute, his head popped up over the car with this confused look. "Yo, Trevor," he said, "your date does not speak English."
"What?"
"Your date. She does not speak any English. That's not possible." I got up and walked over to the car. I asked her a question in English, and she gave me a blank stare. Bongani looked at me. "How did you not know that your date does not speak English?"
I don't know."
"Have you ever spoken to her?"
"Of course I have."
"Oh, wait. Have I?" I started flashing back, through all the times I'd been with Babiki, meeting at her flat, hanging out with her friends, introducing her to Abel. Did I talk to her then? No. Did I talk to her then? No. It was like the scene in Fight Club, where Ed Norton's character flashes back and realizes he and Brad Pitt have never been in the same room with Helena Bonham Carter at the same time. He realizes he's been punching himself the whole time. He's Tyler Durden. In all the excitement of meeting Babiki, the times we were hanging out and getting to know each other, we were never actually speaking to each other. It was always through Tom. Fucking Tom. Tom had promised he'd get me a beautiful date for the dance, but he hadn't made any promises about any of her other qualities. Whenever we were together, she was speaking Betty to Tom, and Tom was speaking English to me. But she didn't speak English, and I didn't speak Betty. Abel spoke Betty. He'd learned several South African languages in order to deal with his customers, so he'd spoken with her fluently when they met. But in that moment I realized I'd never actually heard her say anything in English other than yes, no, hi, bye. That's it. Yes, no, hi, bye. Babiki was so shy that she didn't talk much to begin with, and I was so inept with women that I didn't know how to talk to her. I'd never had a girlfriend. I didn't even know what girlfriend meant. Someone put a beautiful woman on my arm and said, "She's your girlfriend." I'd been mesmerized by her beauty and just the idea of her. I didn't know I was supposed to talk to her. The naked women on my computer, I'd never had to talk to them, ask them their opinions, ask them about their feelings. And I was afraid I'd open my mouth and ruin the whole thing. So I just nodded and smiled along and let Tom do the talking. All three of Babiki's older sisters spoke English, and her younger sister Lerato spoke a little. So whenever we hung out with Babiki and her sisters and their friends, a lot of the conversation was in English. The rest of it was going right by me in Bedi or Sotho, but that's completely normal in South Africa, so it never bothered me. I got enough of the gist of the conversation from everyone's English to know what was going on. And the way my mind works with language, even when I'm hearing other languages, they get filtered into English as I'm hearing them. My mind stores them in English. When my grandmother and great-grandmother were hysterically praying to God to destroy the demon that had shit on their kitchen floor, all of that transpired in Xhosa, but it's stored in English. I remember it as English. So whenever I lay in bed at night, dreaming about Babiki and the moments we'd spent together, I felt like it had transpired in English, because that's how I remembered it. And Tom had never said anything about what language she spoke or didn't speak, because why would he care? He just wanted to get his free CDs and get with the sister, which is how I'd been dating a girl for over a month, the girl I very much believed was my first girlfriend, without ever having had a single conversation with her. Now, the whole night came rushing back, and I saw it from her point of view. And it was perfectly obvious to me why she didn't want to get out of the car. She probably hadn't wanted to go to the dance with me in the first place. She probably owed Tom a favor, and Tom can talk anyone into anything. Then, I'd left her sitting and waiting for me for an hour, and she was pissed off. Then she got into the car, and it was the first time we had ever been alone. And she realized I couldn't even hold a conversation with her. I'd driven her around and gotten lost in the dark. A young girl alone in a car in the middle of nowhere with some strange guy. No idea where I was taking her. She was probably terrified. Then we got to the dance and she didn't speak anyone's language. She didn't know anyone. She didn't even know me. Bongani and I stood outside the car, staring at each other. I didn't know what to do. I tried talking to her in every language I knew. Nothing worked. She only spoke Betty. I got so desperate that I started trying to talk to her using hand signals. Please, you, me, inside, dance, yes, no. Inside, dance, please, no. I asked Bongani if he spoke Betty. He didn't. I ran inside to the dance and ran around looking for someone who spoke Bedi to help me to convince her to come in. Do you speak Bedi? Do you speak Bedi? Do you speak Bedi? Nobody spoke Bedi. So, I never got to go to my matric dance. Other than the 3 minutes I spent running through it looking for someone who spoke Bedi, I spent the whole night in the parking lot. When the dance ended, I climbed back into the shitty red Mazda and drove Babiki home. We sat in total awkward silence the whole way. I pulled up in front of her block of flats in Hillbrow, stopped the car, and sat for a moment as I tried to figure out the polite and gentlemanly way to end the evening. Then, out of nowhere, she leaned over and gave me a kiss. Like a real kiss. A proper kiss. The kind of kiss that made me forget that the whole disaster had just happened. I was so confused. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. She pulled back, and I looked deep into her eyes and thought, I have no idea how girls work. I got out of the car, walked around to her side, and opened her door. She gathered up her dress and stepped out and headed toward her flat. And as she turned to go, I gave her one last little wave. Bye. Bye. Part 3. In Germany, no child finishes high school without learning about the Holocaust. Not just the facts of it, but the how and the why and the gravity of it, what it means. As a result, Germans grow up appropriately aware and apologetic. British schools treat colonialism the same way, to an extent. Their children are taught the history of the empire, with a kind of disclaimer hanging over the whole thing. Well, that was shameful, now wasn't it? In South Africa, the atrocities of apartheid have never been taught that way. We weren't taught judgment or shame. We were taught history, the way it's taught in America. In America, the history of racism is taught like this. There was slavery, and then there was Jim Crow, and then there was Martin Luther King Jr., and now it's done. It was the same for us. Apartheid was bad, Nelson Mandela was freed, let's move on. Facts, but not many, and never the emotional or moral dimension. It was as if the teachers, many of whom were white, had been given a mandate. Whatever you do, don't make the kids angry. 15. Go Hitler. When I was in grade 9, three Chinese kids transferred to Sandringham. Bolo, Bruce Lee, and John. They were the only Chinese pupils in the school out of 1,000. Bolo got his nickname because he looked like Bolo Young from the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie Bloodsport. Bruce Lee's name really was Bruce Lee, which made our lives. Here was this Chinese guy. Quiet, good-looking, in great shape, and his name was Bruce Lee. We were like, this is magic. Thank you, Jesus, for bringing us Bruce Lee. John was just John, which was weird because of the other two. I got to know Bolo because he was one of my tuck shop clients. Bolo's parents were professional pirates. They pirated video games and sold them at flea markets. As the son of pirates, Bolo did the same thing. He started selling bootleg PlayStation games around school. Kids would give him their PlayStation, and he'd bring it back a few days later with a chip in it that enabled them to play pirated games, which he would then sell them. Bolo was friends with this white kid and a fellow pirate named Andrew, who traded in bootleg CDs. Andrew was 2 grades above me, and a real computer geek. He even had a CD writer at home, back when nobody had CD writers. One day on my tuck shop rounds, I heard Andrew and Bolo complaining about the black kids at school. They'd realized that they could take Andrew and Bolo's merchandise, say, I'll pay you later, and then not pay, because Andrew and Bolo were too scared of black people to go back to ask for the money. I leaned into their conversation and said, listen, you shouldn't get upset. Black people don't have any money, so trying to get more stuff for less money is just what we do. But let me help. I'll be your middleman. You give me the merchandise, and I'll sell it. And then I'll handle getting the money. In return, you give me a cut of the sale. They liked the idea right away, and we became partners. As the tuck shop guy, I was perfectly positioned. I had my network set up. All I had to do was tap into it. With the money I made selling CDs and video games, I was able to save up and add new components and more memory to my own computer. Andrew, the computer geek, showed me how to do it, where to buy the cheapest parts, how to assemble them, how to repair them. He showed me how his business worked too, how to download music, where to get rewritable CDs in bulk. The only thing I was missing was my own CD writer, because it was the most expensive component. At the time, a CD writer cost as much as the rest of my computer, nearly 2,000 rand. I worked as a middleman for Bolo and Andrew for a year. Then Bolo left school. The rumor was that his parents got arrested. From that point on, I worked for Andrew. And then, as he was about to matriculate, he decided to quit the game. "Trevor," he told me, "you've been a loyal partner." And as thanks, he bequeathed unto me his CD writer. At the time, black people barely had access to computers. Let's start there. But a CD writer? That was the stuff of lore. It was mythical. The day Andrew gave it to me, he changed my life. Thanks to him, I now controlled production, sales, distribution. I had everything I needed to lock down the bootleg business. I was a natural capitalist. I loved selling stuff, and I was selling something that everybody wanted and nobody else could provide. I sold my discs for 30 rand, around $3. A regular CD in the store cost 100 to 150 rand. Once people started buying from me, they wouldn't buy real CDs ever again. The deal was too good. I had an instinct for business, but at the time, I knew nothing about music, which was odd for someone running a music pirating business. The only music I knew, still, was Christian music from church. The only music allowed in my mother's house. The CD writer Andrew gave me was a 1X CD writer, which meant it copied at the speed it played. Every day I'd leave school, go to my room, and sit for 5 to 6 hours copying CDs. I had my own surround sound system built with old car speakers I'd salvaged from the junkers Abel kept in the yard, and I strung them up around my room. Even though I had to sit there while each CD played, for a long time, I didn't really listen to them. I knew it was against the dealer's code. Never get high on your own supply. Thanks to the internet, I could get anyone anything. I never judged anyone's taste in music. You wanted the new Nirvana? I got you the new Nirvana. You wanted the new DMX? I got you the new DMX. Local South African music was big, but black American music was what people were desperate for. Hip-hop and R&B. Jagged Edge was huge. 112 was huge. I sold a lot of Montel Jordan. So much Montel Jordan. When I started, I had a dial-up connection and a 24K modem. It would take a day to download an album. But technology kept evolving and I kept reinvesting in the business. I upgraded to a 56K modem. I got faster CD writers. Multiple CD writers. I started downloading more. Copying more, selling more. That's when I got two middlemen of my own, my friend Tom, who went to Northview, and my friend Mongani, who lived in Alex. One day, Mongani came to me and said, "You know what would make a lot of money? Instead of copying whole albums, why don't you put the best tracks of different albums onto one CD? Because people only want to hear the songs they like." That sounded like a great idea, so I started making mixed CDs. Those sold well. Then a few weeks later, Bongani came back and said, "Can you make the tracks fade into one another so the music moves from track one to track two without a break and the beat carries on? It'll be like a DJ playing a complete set the whole night." That sounded like a great idea too. I downloaded a program called BPM, Beats Per Minute. It had a graphical interface that looked like two vinyl records side by side, and I could mix and fade between songs. Basically everything a DJ can do live. I started making party CDs, and those started selling like hotcakes too. Business was booming. By matric, I was balling, making 500 rand a week. To put that in perspective, there are maids in South Africa who still earn less than that today. It's a shit salary if you're trying to support a family, but as a 16-year-old living at home with no real expenses, I was living the dream. For the first time in my life, I had money, and it was the most liberating thing in the world. The first thing I learned about having money was that it gives you choices. People don't want to be rich. They want to be able to choose. The richer you are, the more choices you have. That is the freedom of money. With money, I experienced freedom on a whole new level. I went to McDonald's. People in America don't understand, but when an American chain opens in a third world country, people go crazy. That's true to this day. A Burger King opened for the first time in South Africa last year, and there was a queue around the block. It was an event. Everyone was going around saying, "I have to eat at Burger King. Have you heard? It's from America." The funny thing was that the queue was actually just white people. White people went batshit crazy for Burger King. Black people were like, whatever. Black people didn't need Burger King. Our hearts were with KFC and McDonald's. The crazy thing about McDonald's is that we knew about it long before it came, probably from movies. We never even dreamed we would ever get one in South Africa. McDonald's seemed to us like one of those American things that is exclusively American and can't go anywhere else. Even before we ever tasted McDonald's, we knew we'd love it. And we did. At one point, South Africa was opening more McDonald's than any other country in the world. With Mandela came freedom, and with freedom came McDonald's. A McDonald's had opened up just two blocks from our house, not long after we moved to Highlands North. But my mom would never pay for us to eat there. With my own money, I was like, let's do this. I went all in. They didn't have supersize at the time. Large was the biggest. So I walked up to the counter, feeling very impressed with myself, and I put down my money and said, "I'll have a large number one." I fell in love with McDonald's. McDonald's to me tasted like America. McDonald's is America. You see it advertised and it looks amazing. You crave it. You buy it. You take your first bite and it blows your mind. It's even better than you imagined. Then, halfway through, you realize it's not all it's cracked up to be. A few bites later, you're like, there's a lot wrong with this. Then you're done. You miss it like crazy, and you go back for more. Once I'd had the taste of America, I never ate at home. I only ate McDonald's. McDonald's, 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 McDonald's. Every night, my mom would try to cook me dinner. "Tonight we're having chicken livers." "No, I'm gonna have McDonald's." "Tonight we're having dog bones." "I think I'm gonna go with McDonald's again." "Tonight we're having chicken feet." Okay, I'm in. But tomorrow, I'm eating McDonald's. The money kept rolling in, and I was bawling out of control. This is how bawling I was. I bought a cordless telephone. This was before everyone had a cell phone. The range on this cordless phone was strong enough that I could put the base outside my window, walk the two blocks to McDonald's, order my large number one, walk back home, go up to my room, and fire up my computer, carrying on a conversation the whole time. I was that dude walking down the street holding a giant phone to my ear with the aerial fully extended, talking to my friend. "Yeah, I'm just going down to McDonald's." Life was good, and none of it would have happened without Andrew. Without him, I would never have mastered the world of music piracy and lived a life of endless McDonald's. What he did on a small scale showed me how important it is to empower the dispossessed and the disenfranchised in the wake of oppression. Andrew was white. His family had access to education, resources, computers. For generations, while his people were preparing to go to university, my people were crowded into thatched huts singing, 2 times 2 is 4, 3 times 2 is 6, la 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 la. My family had been denied the things his family had taken for granted. I had a natural talent for selling to people, but without knowledge and resources, where was that going to get me? People always lecture the poor. Take responsibility for yourself. Make something of yourself. But with what raw materials are the poor to make something of themselves? People love to say, "Give a man a fish, and he'll eat for a day. Teach a man to fish, and he'll eat for a lifetime." What they don't say is, "And it would be nice if you gave him a fishing rod." That's the part of the analogy that's missing. Working with Andrew was the first time in my life I realized you need someone from the privileged world to come to you and say, okay, here's what you need, and here's how it works. Talent alone would have gotten me nowhere without Andrew giving me the CD writer. People say, oh, that's a handout. No, I still have to work to profit by it, but I don't stand a chance without it. One afternoon, I was in my room making a CD when Bongani came over to pick up his inventory. He saw me mixing songs on my computer.
That is insane, he said. Are you doing this live?
Yeah.
Trevor, I don't think you understand. You're sitting on a gold mine. We need to do this for a crowd. You need to come to the township and start DJing gigs. No one has ever seen a DJ playing on a computer before.
Bongani lived in Alexandra. Where Soweto is a sprawling government-planned ghetto, Alexandra is a tiny, dense pocket of a shanty town, left over from the pre-apartheid days. Rows and rows of cinder block and corrugated iron shacks, practically stacked on top of one another. Its nickname is Gomorrah, because it has the wildest parties and the worst crimes. Street parties are the best thing about Alexandra. You get a tent, put it up in the middle of the road, take over the street, and you've got a party. There's no formal invitations or guest list. You just tell a few people. Word of mouth travels, and a crowd appears. There are no permits, nothing like that. If you own a tent, you have the right to throw a party in your street. Cars creep up to the intersection, and the driver will see the party blocking their way and shrug and make a U-turn. Nobody gets upset. The only rule is that if you throw a party in front of somebody's house, they get to come and share your alcohol. The parties don't end until someone gets shot or a bottle gets broken on someone's face. That's how it has to end. Otherwise, it wasn't a party. Back then, most DJs could spin for only a few hours. They were limited by the number of vinyls they could buy. Since parties went all night, you might need 5 or 6 DJs to keep the dancing going. But I had a massive hard drive stuffed with MP3s, which is why Bongani was excited when he saw me mixing. He saw a way to corner the market.
How much music do you have? He asked.
Winam says I can play for a week.
We'll make a fortune.
Our first gig was a New Year's Eve party the summer we graduated from Sandringham. Bongani and I took my tower, my giant monitor, and all the cables and the keyboard and the mouse. We loaded everything up in a minibus and brought it over to Alex. We took over the street in front of his house, ran the electricity out of his place, set up the computer, set up the speakers, and borrowed a tent. And people came. It was explosive. By midnight, the whole street was packed from one end to the other. Ours was the biggest New Year's Eve party in Alexandra that year, and to have the biggest party in Alexandra is no joke. All night, from far and wide, people kept coming. The word spread. There's a light-skinned guy who plays music on a computer. You've never seen anything like it. I DJed by myself until dawn. By then, me and my friends were so drunk and exhausted that we passed out on the lawn outside Bongani's house. The party was so big, it made our reputation in the hood instantly. Pretty soon, we were getting booked all over, which was a good thing. When Bongani and I graduated from high school, we couldn't get jobs. There were no jobs for us to get. The only ways I had to make money were pirating CDs and DJing parties. And now that I'd left Sandringham, the minibus drivers and corner kids in Alexandra were the single biggest market for my CDs. It was also where I was playing the most gigs. So to keep earning, I naturally gravitated that way. Most of the white kids I knew were taking a gap year. I'm going to take a gap year and go to Europe. That's what the white kids were saying. So I said, I too am going to take a gap year. I'm going to take a year and go to the township and hang out on the corner. And that's what I did. There was a low brick wall running down the middle of the road in front of Bongani's house in Alex. And every day, Bongani and I and our crew would go sit on the wall. I'd bring my CDs, we'd play music and practice dance moves. We hustled CDs all day and DJed parties at night. We started getting booked for gigs in other townships, other hoods. Thanks to my computer and modem, I was getting exclusive tracks few people had access to. But that created a problem for me. Sometimes, I'd play the new music at parties, and people would stand around going, "What is this? How do you dance to it?" For example, if a DJ plays a song like "Watch Me Whip, Watch Me Nene," yeah, it's a catchy song, but what is a whip? What is a nene? For that song to be popular, you have to know how to do the whip and the nene. New music works at parties only if people know how to dance to it. Bongani decided we needed a dance crew to show people the steps to the songs we were playing. Because we spent our days doing nothing but listening to CDs and coming up with dance moves, our crew from the corner already knew all the songs, so they became our dancers. And hands down, the best, most beautiful, most graceful dancer in the crew was Bongani's neighbor, Hitler. Hitler was a great friend of mine, and good Lord could that guy dance. He was mesmerizing to watch. He had a looseness and a fluidity that defied physics. Imagine a jellyfish if it could walk on land. Incredibly handsome too, tall and lithe and muscular, with beautiful smooth skin, big teeth and a great smile, always laughing. And all he did was dance. He'd be up in the morning, blasting house music or hip-hop, practicing moves the whole day. In the hood, everybody knows who the best dancer in the crew is. He's like your status symbol. When you're poor, you don't have cars or nice clothes, but the best dancer gets girls. So that's the guy you want to roll with. Hitler was our guy. There were parties with dance competitions. Kids from every neighborhood would come and bring their best dancers. We'd always bring Hitler. And he almost always won. When Bongani and I put together a routine for our dance crew, there was no question who was going to be the star attraction. We built the whole set around Hitler. I'd warm the crowd up with a few songs. Then the dancers would come out and do a couple of numbers. Once they'd gotten the party started, they'd fan out to form a semicircle around the stage with a gap in the back for Hitler to enter. I'd crank up Redman's "Let's Get Dirty" and start whipping the crowd up even more. "Are you ready? I can't hear you. Let me hear you make some noise." People would start screaming, and Hitler would jump into the middle of the semicircle, and the crowd would lose it. Hitler would do his thing while the guys circled around him, shouting him on. "Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler!" And because this was hip-hop, the crew would do that thing where you shoot your arm out in front of you with your palm flat, bopping it up and down to the beat. "Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler!" We'd have the whole crowd in a frenzy. 1,000 people in the streets, chanting along with their hands in the air. "Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler! Go, Hitler!" Hitler, although an unusual name, is not unheard of in South Africa. Part of it has to do with the way a lot of black people pick names. Black people choose their traditional names with great care. Those are the names that have deeply personal meanings. But from colonial times through the days of apartheid, black people in South Africa were required to have an English or European name as well, a name that white people could pronounce, basically. So you had your English name, your traditional name, and your last name. Patricia Nombuyiselo Noah. 9 times out of 10, your European name was chosen at random, plucked from the Bible, or taken from a Hollywood celebrity or a famous politician in the news. I know guys named after Mussolini and Napoleon, and of course, Hitler. Westerners are shocked and confused by that. But really, it's a case of the West reaping what it has sown. The colonial powers carved up Africa, put the black man to work, and did not properly educate him. White people don't talk to black people. So why would black people know what's going on in the white man's world? Because of that, many black people in South Africa don't really know who Hitler was. My own grandfather thought a Hitler was a kind of army tank that was helping the Germans win the war, because that's what he took from what he heard on the news. For many black South Africans, the story of the war was that there was someone called Hitler, and he was the reason the Allies were losing the war. This Hitler was so powerful that at some point, black people had to go help white people fight against him, And if the white man has to stoop to ask the black man for help fighting someone, that someone must be the toughest guy of all time. So, if you want your dog to be tough, you name your dog Hitler. If you want your kid to be tough, you name your kid Hitler. There's a good chance you've got an uncle named Hitler. It's just a thing. At Sandringham, we were taught more about World War II than the typical black kids in the townships were, but only in a basic way. We weren't taught to think critically about Hitler and anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. We weren't taught, for instance, that the architects of apartheid were big fans of Hitler, and that the racist policies they put in place were inspired, in part, by the racist policies of the Third Reich. We weren't taught how to think about how Hitler related to the world we lived in. We weren't being taught to think, period. All we were taught was that in 1939, Hitler invaded Poland, and in 1941, he invaded the Soviet Union, and in 1943, he did something else. They're just facts. Memorize them, write them down for the test, and forget them. There is also this to consider. The name Hitler does not offend a black South African, because Hitler is not the worst thing a black South African can imagine. Every country thinks their history is the most important, and that's especially true in the West. But if black South Africans could go back in time and kill one person, Cecil John Rhodes would come up before Hitler. If people in the Congo could go back in time and kill one person, Belgium's King Leopold would come way before Hitler. If Native Americans could go back in time and kill one person, it would probably be Christopher Columbus or Andrew Jackson. I often meet people in the West who insist the Holocaust was the worst atrocity in human history, without question. Yes, it was horrific. But I often wonder, with African atrocities like in the Congo, how horrific were they? The thing Africans don't have, that Jewish people do have, is documentation. The Nazis kept meticulous records, took pictures, made films. And that's really what it comes down to. Holocaust victims count because Hitler counted them. 6 million people killed. We can all look at that number and rightly be horrified. But when you read through the history of atrocities against Africans, there are no numbers, only guesses. It's harder to be horrified by a guess. When Portugal and Belgium were plundering Angola and the Congo, they weren't counting the black people they slaughtered. How many black people died harvesting rubber in the Congo, in the gold and diamond mines of the Transvaal? So, in Europe and America, yes, Hitler is the greatest madman in history. In Africa, he's just another strong man from the history books. In all my time hanging out with Hitler, I never once asked myself, why is his name Hitler? His name was Hitler because his mom named him Hitler. Once Bongani and I added the dancers to our DJ sets, we blew up. We called our group the Black and White Boys. The dancers were called the Springbok Boys. We started getting booked everywhere. Successful black families were moving to the suburbs, but their kids still wanted to have block parties and stay connected to the culture of the townships. So they'd book us to play their parties. Word of mouth traveled. Pretty soon, we were getting booked more and more in the suburbs, meeting white people, playing for white people. One kid we knew from the township, his mother was involved in creating cultural programs for schools. In America, they'd be called diversity programs. They were springing up all over South Africa because we were supposed to be learning about and embracing one another in this post-apartheid era. This kid's mom asked us if we wanted to play at a cultural day at some school in Linksfield, the wealthy suburb south of Sandringham where my pal Teddy had lived. There was going to be all sorts of different dancing and music, and everyone was going to come together and hang out and be cultural. She offered to pay, so we said sure. She sent us the information with the time and place and the name of the school, the King David School, a Jewish school. The day of the event, we booked a minibus, loaded it up with our gear, and drove over. Once we arrived, we waited in the back of the school's assembly hall and watched the acts that went on stage before us. Different groups took their turns performing. Flamenco dancers, Greek dancers, traditional Zulu musicians. Then we were up. We were billed as the hip-hop Pantsula dancers, the South African B-boys. We set up our sound system on stage. I looked out, and the whole hall was nothing but Jewish kids in their yarmulkes, ready to party. I got on the mic. "Are you ready to rock out? Yeah! Make some noise! Yeah!" I started playing. The bass was bumping. My crew was dancing and everyone was having a great time. The teachers, the chaperones, the parents, hundreds of kids, they were all dancing like crazy. Our set was scheduled for 15 minutes, and at the 10-minute mark came the moment for me to play Let's Get Dirty, bring out my star dancer, and shut shit down. I started the song. The dancers fanned out in their semicircle, and I got on the mic.
"Are you guys ready? Yeah! You guys are not ready. Are you ready? Yeah! All right, give it up and make some noise for Hitler!"
Hitler jumped out to the middle of the circle and started killing it. The guys around him were all chanting,
"Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler!"
They had their arms out in front of them, bouncing to the rhythm,
"Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler!"
And I was right there on the mic, leading them along, "Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler!" The whole room stopped. No one was dancing. The teachers, the chaperones, the parents, the hundreds of Jewish kids in their yarmulkes, they froze and stared aghast at us up on the stage. I was oblivious. So was Hitler. We kept going. For a good 30 seconds, the only sound in the room was the beats of the music and me on the mic yelling,
"Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Put your hands in the air for Hitler, yo!"
A teacher ran up behind me and yanked the plug for my system out of the wall. The hall went dead silent, and she turned on me and she was livid.
"How dare you! This is disgusting! You horrible, disgusting, vile creature! How dare you!"
My mind was racing, trying to figure out what she was talking about. Then it clicked. Hitler had a special dance move called Uspanava. It means where you work, and it was very sexual. His hips would gyrate and thrust like he was fucking the air. That was the move he was doing at the moment the teacher ran out. So clearly, the dance was the thing she found so disgusting. But this was a move that African people do all the time. It's part of our culture. Here we were, sharing our culture for a cultural day. And this woman was calling us disgusting? She was offended, and I was offended by her taking offense. "Lady," I said, "I think you need to calm down."
"I will not calm down. How dare you come here and insult us?"
"This is not insulting anyone. This is who we are."
"Get out of here. You people are disgusting."
And there it was. You people. Now I saw what the deal was. This lady was racist. She couldn't see black men dancing suggestively and not get pissed off. As I started packing up my gear, we kept arguing. "Listen, lady. We're free now. We're gonna do what we're gonna do. You can't stop us."
"I'll have you know that my people stopped people like you before, and we can stop you again."
She was talking, of course, about stopping the Nazis in World War II, but that's not what I was hearing. Jews in South Africa are just white people. All I was hearing was some white lady shouting about how white people beat us before and they'll beat us again. I said,
"You will never stop us again, lady."
And here's where I played the trump card.
"You'll never stop us, because now we have Nelson Mandela on our side, and he told us we can do this."
"What?"
She was so confused. I'd had it. I started cussing her out.
"Fuck you, lady. Fuck your program, fuck your school, fuck your whole people. Let's go, guys, we're out."
We didn't walk out of that school. We danced out. We danced down the street, pumping our fists in the air.
Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler! Go Hitler!
Because Hitler had shut shit down. Hitler had the most gangster dance moves ever, and those white people didn't know what hit them. Alexandra was a farm originally named for the wife of a white man who owned it. Like Sophiatown and other black spots populating white areas before apartheid, Alex started out as a squatter settlement where blacks gathered and lived when coming to Johannesburg to find work. What was unique about Alex is that this farmer sold plots of land to some of the black tenants in the time before it was illegal for blacks to own property. So, while Sophiatown and other black ghettos were raised and rebuilt as white suburbs, Alex fought and held on and asserted its right to exist. Wealthy white suburbs like Sandton grew around it, but Alex remained. More squatters came, and more squatters came, putting up makeshift shacks and shanties. They look like the slums in Mumbai or the favelas in Brazil. The first time I saw the favelas in Rio, I said, yeah, that's Alexandra, but on a hill. Soweto was beautiful because, after democracy, you watched Soweto grow. Soweto has become a proper city unto itself. People went from three-room houses to five-room houses to three-bedroom houses with garages. There was room to grow because the piece of land from the government gave you something to build on. Alexandra can't do that. Alex can't get any bigger because it's pinned in on all sides, and it can't build up because it's mostly shacks. When democracy came, people flooded into Alex from the homelands, building new shacks in the backyards of other shacks, with still more shacks attached to the backside of those shacks, growing more dense and more compressed, leaving close to 200,000 people living in a few square kilometers. Even if you go back today, Alex hasn't changed. It can't change. It's physically impossible for it to change. It can only be what it is. 16. The Cheese Boys. My friend Mongani was a short, bald, super buff guy. He wasn't always that way. His whole life he'd been skinny, and then a bodybuilding magazine found its way into his hands and changed his life. Mongani was one of those people who brought out the best in everybody. He was that friend who believed in you and saw the potential in you that nobody else did, which was why so many of the township kids gravitated toward him, and why I gravitated toward him as well. Mongani was always popular, but his reputation really took off when he beat up one of the more infamous bullies in the school. That cemented his status as sort of the leader and protector of the township kids. Mongani lived in Alex, but I never visited him there while we were still in school. He'd always come to my house in Highlands North. I'd been to Alex a few times for brief visits, but I'd never spent any real time there. I've never been there at night. Let's put it that way. Going to Alex during the day is different from going there at night. The place was nicknamed Gomorrah for a reason. One day after school, not long before we matriculated, Mongani walked up to me on the quad. "Hey, let's go to the hood," he said. "The hood?" At first, I had no idea what he was talking about. I knew the word hood from rap songs, and I knew the different townships where black people lived, but I had never used the one to describe the other. The walls of apartheid were coming down just as American hip-hop was blowing up, and hip-hop made it cool to be from the hood. Before, living in a township was something to be ashamed of. It was the bottom of the bottom. Then, we had movies like Boys in the Hood and Menace to Society, and they made the hood look cool. The characters in those movies, in the songs, they owned it. Kids in the townships started doing the same, wearing their identity as a badge of honor. You were no longer from the township. You were from the hood. Being from Alex gave you way more street cred than living in Highlands North. So when Mongani said, "Let's go to the hood," I was curious about what he meant. I wanted to find out more. When Mongani took me to Alex, we entered as most people do, from the Sandton side. You ride through one of the richest neighborhoods in Johannesburg, past palatial mansions and huge money. Then you go through the industrial belt of Wynberg that cordons off the rich and white from the poor and black. At the entrance to Alex, there's the huge minibus rank and the bus station. It's the same bustling, chaotic third world marketplace you see in James Bond and Jason Bourne movies. It's Grand Central Station, but outdoors. Everything's dynamic. Everything's in motion. Nothing feels like it was there yesterday, and nothing feels like it'll be there tomorrow. But every day, it looks exactly the same. Right next to the minibus rank, of course, is a KFC. That's one thing about South Africa. There's always a KFC. KFC found the black people. KFC did not play games. They were in the hood before McDonald's, before Burger King, before anyone. KFC was like, yo, we're here for you. Once you go past the minibus rank, you're in Alex proper. I've been in few places where there's an electricity like there is in Alex. It's a hive of constant human activity. All day long, people coming and going, gangsters hustling, guys on the corner doing nothing, kids running around. There's nowhere for all that energy to go, no mechanism for it to dissipate. So it erupts periodically in epic acts of violence and crazy parties. 1 minute, it'll be a placid afternoon, people hanging out, doing their thing. And the next thing you know, there's a cop car chasing gangsters, flying through the streets. A gun battle going off, helicopters circling overhead. Then, 10 minutes later, it's like it never happened. Everyone's back to hanging out, back to the hustle, coming and going, running around. Alex is laid out on a grid, a series of avenues. The streets are paved, but the sidewalks are mostly dirt. The color scheme is cinder block and corrugated iron, gray and dark gray, punctuated by bright splashes of color. Someone's painted a wall lime green, or there's a bright red sign above a takeaway shop, or maybe somebody's picked up a bright blue piece of sheet metal just by luck. There's little in the way of basic sanitation. Trash is everywhere. Typically, a garbage fire going down some side streets. There's always something burning in the hood. As you walk, there's every smell you can imagine. People are cooking, eating takeaways in the streets. Some family has a shack that's jury-rigged onto the back of someone else's shack, and they don't have any running water. So they've bathed in a bucket from the outdoor tap and then dumped the dirty water in the streets, where it runs into the river of sewage that's already there because the water system has backed up again. There's a guy fixing cars who thinks he knows what he's doing, but he doesn't. He's dumping old motor oil into the streets, and now the oil is combining with the dirty bathwater to make a river of filth running down the streets. There's probably a goat hanging around. There's always a goat. As you're walking, sound washes over you. The steady thrum of human activity. People talking in a dozen different languages. Chatting, haggling, arguing. There's music playing constantly. You've got traditional South African music coming from one corner, someone blasting Dolly Parton from the next corner, and somebody driving past pumping the Notorious B.I.G. The hood was a complete sensory overload for me. But within the chaos, there was order, a system, a social hierarchy based on where you lived. First Avenue was not cool at all, because it was right next to the commotion of the minibus rank. Second Avenue was nice because it had semi-houses that were built when there was still some sort of formal settlement going on. Third, Fourth, and Fifth Avenues were nicer for the township. These were the established families, the old money. Then, from Sixth Avenue on down, it got really shitty. More shacks and shanties. There were some schools, a few soccer fields. There were a couple of hostels. Giant projects built by government for housing migrant workers. You never wanted to go there. That's where the serious gangsters were. You only went there if you needed to buy an AK-47. After 20th Avenue, you hit the Yukske River. And on the far side of that, across the Roosevelt Street Bridge, was East Bank. The newest, nicest part of the hood. East Bank was where the government had gone in, cleared out the squatters and their shacks, and started to build actual homes. It was still low-income housing, but decent, two-bedroom houses with tiny yards. The families who lived there had a bit of money and usually sent their kids out of the hood to better schools, like Sandringham. Bongani's parents lived in East Bank, at the corner of Roosevelt and Springbok Crescent, and after walking from the minibus rank through the hood, we wound up there, hanging around outside his house on the low brick wall down the middle of Springbok Crescent, doing nothing, shooting the shits. I didn't know it then, but I was about to spend the next 3 years of my life hanging out at that very spot. I graduated from high school when I was 17, and by that point, life at home had become toxic because of my stepfather. I didn't want to be there anymore, and my mom agreed that I should move out. She helped me move to a cheap, roach-infested flat in a building down the road. My plan, insofar as I had one, was to go to university to be a computer programmer. But we couldn't afford the tuition. I needed to make money. The only way I knew how to make money was selling pirated CDs. And one of the best places to sell CDs was in the hood, because that's where the minibus rank was. Minibus drivers were always looking for new songs, because having good music was something they used to attract customers. Another nice thing about the hood was that it's super cheap. You can get by on next to nothing. There's a meal you can get in the hood called a quarta. It's a quarter loaf of bread. You scrape out the bread, then you fill it with fried potatoes, a slice of bologna, and some pickled mango relish called acha. That costs a couple of rand. The more money you have, the more upgrades you can buy. If you have a bit more money, you can throw in a hot dog. If you have a bit more than that, you can throw in a proper sausage, like a bratwurst, or maybe a fried egg. The biggest one with all the upgrades is enough to feed 3 people. For us, the ultimate upgrade was to throw on a slice of cheese. Cheese was always the thing because it was so expensive. Forget the gold standard. The hood operated on the cheese standard. Cheese on anything was money. If you got a burger, that was cool. But if you got a cheeseburger, that meant you had more money than a guy who just got a hamburger. Cheese on a sandwich, cheese in your fridge, that meant you were living the good life. In any township in South Africa, if you had a bit of money, people would say, "Oh, you're a cheese boy." In essence, you're not really hood because your family has enough money to buy cheese. In Alex, because Bongani and his crew lived in East Bank, they were considered cheese boys. Ironically, because they lived on the first street just over the river, they were looked down on as the scruff of East Bank, and the kids in the nicer houses higher up in East Bank were the cheesier cheese boys. Bongani and his crew would never admit to being cheese boys. They would insist, "We're not cheese, we're hood." But then the real hood guys would say, "Hey, you're not hood, you're cheese." "We're not cheese," Bongani's guys would say, pointing further up East Bank, "they're cheese." It was all a bunch of ridiculous posturing about who was hood and who was cheese. Bongani was the leader of his crew, the guy who got everyone together and got things moving. Then there was Mzi, Bongani's henchman. Small guy, just wanted to tag along, be in the mix. Beggy was the drinks man, always finding us booze and always coming up with an excuse to drink. Then there was Tlokotsi. We called him G, Mr. Nice Guy. All G was interested in was women. If women were in the mix, he was in the game. Then finally, there was Hitler, the life of the party. Hitler just wanted to dance. Cheese boys were in a uniquely fucked situation when apartheid ended. It is one thing to be born in the hood and know that you will never leave the hood. But the cheese boy has been shown the world outside. His family has done okay. They have a house. They've sent him to a decent school. Maybe he's even matriculated. He has been given more potential, but he has not been given more opportunity. He has been given an awareness of the world that is out there, but he has not been given the means to reach it. The unemployment rate, technically speaking, was lower in South Africa during apartheid, which makes sense. There was slavery. That's how everyone was employed. When democracy came, everyone had to be paid a minimum wage. The cost of labor went up, and suddenly, millions of people were out of work. The unemployment rate for young black men post-apartheid shot up, sometimes as high as 50%. What happens to a lot of guys is they finish high school, and they can't afford university. And even little retail jobs can be hard to come by when you're from the hood and you look and talk a certain way. So, for many young men in South African townships, freedom looks like this. Every morning, they wake up. Maybe their parents go to work, or maybe not. Then they go outside and chill on the corner the whole day, talking shit. They're free. They've been taught how to fish, but no one will give them a fishing rod. One of the first things I learned in the hood is that there's a very fine